If I drop out of this thing, I am going to get so much grief from so many people. and honestly, it took the next 7 miles to like admit that and be like, okay, well, here goes.
Hey, are you loving those new La Sportiva Cyclone shoes with the BOA fit system that we received in the mail the other day, Don?
Scott, I love them. It's because when you dial in the BOA fit system, it just snugs your foot completely in the shoe. It's not like a lacing system. The BOA system is modern and it works.
And it's functional, designed by biomechanics in a lab to figure out how to improve your running efficiency, reduce landing impact, and secure your fit on technical terrain.
Those biomechanists have figured out a way to make the La Sportiva Cyclone perform even better with the BOA Fit system, and they are available for both men and women.
And we want to tell you how you can get dialed in, locked in, and connected to the trail in the BOA-powered La Sportiva Cyclone. We're giving away 10 free pairs of these Cyclone shoes, and the way that you enter is to go to boafit.com/trn,
and winners will be announced July 16th, and that's just 1 month away, Scott. We also partner with companies that make great stuff, but they're also great companies too.
Jonji's one of those partners. They make great gear for men and women and prints that have been inspired by artists around the world, including outerwear, accessories, tops, bottoms, including that great AFO vent multi-short that we've been talking about with the pockets and the perforated venting.
We're excited to tease you about an initiative that will bring awareness to water and create an adventure run for you at the same time.
Jonji will be launching the Follow the H2O Run. Basically, what you will do is you'll join the Jonji Follow the H2O group, and then you will map out a run from your local water source to your home.
Jonji is raising awareness and opportunity for people to drink clean water. How cool is that, Scott?
Great. And we'll have more information on this to come. But don't forget that TRN members get 15% off at jonji.com with the code TRN15 at checkout.
Ladies and gentlemen of the wide, worldwide ultra running community, you are listening to nothing less than the greatest Trail Running Nation podcast on earth. It is the Trail Runner Nation podcast.
But I know it's on the upper edge, and you guys have won a couple of awards. And
just because the facts aren't accurate, don't worry about it. This is a podcast. We don't even have a letterbox. Nobody's going to write us. We don't even know where it is. I started to question myself. Maybe I'm a badminton player and not a runner.
Thanks for joining another edition of Trail Runner Nation. My name is Scott War.
And I'm Don Freeman.
And I'm Andy Jones Wilkins. And welcome to this special Anatomy of a DNF Part 2.
Oh, no. This is called Post-Mortem, AJW.
And okay.
And just so I knew that I was using the term properly, I asked Google for the definition. An examination of a dead body to determine the cause of death. And that fits precisely into this podcast, because AJW, our resident coach and expert, our mentor, and many of us has followed his advice, has now joined the club and is 184-1. And what does that mean, AJW? Tell us about the 184-1.
Well, yesterday morning, I was 184-0. I started 184 ultras and finished them all. And yesterday I started an ultra here in Pennsylvania, the World's End Ultra 100K, and I didn't finish. I pulled the plug not very far into it, actually, at mile 22 and a half. Oh. And for the first time in my life, I got a ride back to the finish line in a car.
22 and a half AJW. That isn't something that you would predict. Let me ask you, did you have any concern that that might have happened going into this race, or did you feel fairly confident?
No, I felt good coming into the race. I was trained up. I was planning on taking it very easy as a training run for Bighorn, which is in 2 weeks, and the day turned out to not be the day that I thought it was going to be.
Now, just for fun, I'm going to play a clip right now from our last week's
episode where we were doing Nugget Cast, and we were talking, we were doing some foreshadowing, and I think that Don may have jinxed your race, Andy. I think that he may have jinxed your race. Let's listen to that quote right now.
A question: Would you? You're in the middle of the 100K. You're at 60K into it of the 100K, and all of a sudden things are falling apart a little bit. And let's hope that it doesn't happen. But if it does, do you push yourself through, or do you pull early so you preserve yourself for the 100?
So, Andy, do you think that Don jinxed your race? Did that play in your mind that he was predicting that there may be a DNF in your future?
No, I don't think Don is that good at playing head games.
Here are some of the thoughts I had, AJW, kind of a postmortem. Let's figure out what's going on, because out of anything that doesn't happen quite right on the trail, we have to kind of rewind, go back through and see where it went off the rails. And so I'm just kind of start chronologically from the race prep. All right. So the miles to ramp up for 100K, were you happy with your race preparation to get to this distance with your experience and knowledge?
I had basically been doing a 50 miler or equivalent once a month from January to now. I'd done a 50 miler in January, February, and March. I did a 3-day stage race that was about 94 miles over 3 days. And then in April and May, I did two other 50 mile races, all of which went well, all of which I finished, you know, in a comfortable time, running a comfortable pace, all of which I recovered from pretty quickly. So I really didn't see this coming.
Yeah, well, Scott, you and I are actually the physicians on this case. And right now, I don't see this as the cause of death. He's done the work. He's prepped sufficiently. The confidence is there. His resume is deep. And so he didn't make a foolish decision here.
And we also found out from the most recent Nugget Cast that he has also been training his brain twice as much as he's been training his body. So did you feel that your mind was wrapped around this race?
Yeah, and it was. And in fact, in contrast to all the rest of the times where I've used my mind to push through to a finish, in this case, my mind actually helped make the drop easier.
AJW, you've got the miles in, but what about taper? You've got 100 mile coming up in a couple of weeks. I know that's your A race right now. So did you give some taper to this race, or did you just go in mid high mileage week training?
I went in mid high mileage week training. I had run 44 miles on Monday through Friday. So it was going to, had I finished the 63 miles, you know, it would have been 107, 108 mile week, which was my goal. I wanted to have one big heavy week. As it turned out to be a 72 mile week.
Do you think that played any part of your DNF high mileage week going in without a taper?
Yeah, I think it probably did.
So if Coach Andy was coaching athlete Andy, would he, in retrospect, would he have said, hey, maybe you need to have a little bit of a taper. Let's use this as a good long training run. There's no reason to put a 44 mile week in prior to this 100K.
Yeah, I think so. Or I would have said to athlete Andy, how about you just sign up for the 50K? You know, there's also a 50K there that's on very many of the similar trails and so forth. So, and that's actually what my wife and son said. They said, you know, maybe if you could do it over again, you would have signed up for the 50K. And that's probably a personality problem that I have. You know, I'm kind of a more is better person. And I think that might have been a definite factor in my dropping out. And especially being able to not drop out with any remorse. I mean, I got to the aid station, mile 22 and a half. I said, hey, look, I'm going to need to sit down. I've got this, I had hip resurfacing, you know, several years ago. I think I'm going to have to drop out. And within like 3 minutes, I was like, hey, I'm going to drop out. So there was none of the usual heart-wrenching stuff I've seen when I've worked at aid stations with people dropping out. So it was, I think definitely the week leading up to it probably played a role in maybe making me more susceptible to this injury that I had, and maybe made me a little bit more fatigued, and therefore it was easier for me to just pull the plug.
So as coroners, Don and I are going through our checklist. We have our clipboard with a checklist. We've gone over the miles, ramping up. We've gone over taper. Tell us about the course. Have you run the course before?
Excellent question. I had not run the course. I was familiar with it because I've coached athletes who have run World's End, and I know the race director. And so there was nothing about it that was surprising, other than how early in the course, how early in the race, the long, steep, rocky climbs started. And I will say, you might recall in the last podcast we recorded, we talked about the training of the mind and when that gentleman broke my bottle at Western States. And this race, there's this rocky section, literally at mile two. I was using poles because I wanted to practice with my poling for Bighorn. I snapped my pole. And it got stuck in a rock, and it was carbon fiber. It just snapped in half. I don't think that's a reason for dropping out, but there's a part of me that thinks maybe that got in a little bit to my head. Like, here I am at mile two, and now I don't have poles anymore. And I was fully planning on running with poles for 62 miles. And so that was a little bit of a surprise early on that I think I had to adjust to on the fly. I remember as well, there was a lot of mud, and I knew there was going to be a lot of mud. And I also know I'm susceptible because of my hips to slipping around. And as you guys know, you run with poles, they can act as a third and fourth leg sometimes. And you can use those poles to keep you from slipping or from slipping too much. So I think that played a little bit of a role also.
You know, as coroners, Scott and I are very thorough. And some of these questions might seem routine to you, but just know that to experts like Scott and I, they're very meaningful and they're layered and complex. And we run algorithms through our own mind, through our experience. So put up with some of these questions. We're going to talk about sleep, the week before sleep, because some of your attitude, some of the ability to reach deep could come from just good, solid rest. Were you happy with your sleep?
Very good question. I had a bad night's sleep on the Thursday, which of course we all know if, on a Saturday race, your most important night's sleep is the 2 days before because you're going to toss and turn the night before. I think I got 8 hours of sleep, but when I look back on it, it was disrupted sleep. And part of it was, you know, I have a family. My middle son is a bicycle racer. He was traveling out to a big race in Kansas, the Unbound Gravel Race, which he did very well at, by the way. But I was preoccupied. I had a phone conversation with him about race strategy and nutrition that night. And I think it got in my head. And I woke up a couple of times during that night thinking about him and about his race and how I wanted him to execute. And so it was not a satisfied night's sleep. The next night, it was a short night's sleep because I had to get up at 3:30 to be at the 5 o'clock start. So I was not 100% happy with my sleep.
Mm. Did that play in your mind at all? I mean, did you at the starting line, were you worried about that Thursday night sleep or did you brush it off?
I wasn't worried about it. I was worried about it, though, after I started feeling my hip and going up some of these climbs. And as I was mentioning, directing my mental energy towards that injury, I felt like it's taking away from directing my mental energy to other things and that I might not be as well equipped to have mental energy because I was somewhat sleep deprived.
And I think it really speaks to the point of an extra run probably isn't as beneficial as a little more sleep because you're not going to get in better shape that week, but you certainly could decrease your fitness level for not banking some of those sleeping hours if banking sleep's even possible. How about the travel to the race? Sometimes that's fatiguing too. Was this a short travel, a long travel? Because that can deteriorate and dig into your resources as well.
I think that you asked a great question there. So it's about 50 minutes, 50 minutes from my house. And they have a mandatory pre-race meeting the night before. So I actually drove the 50 minutes on Friday night, went to the pre-race meeting, picked up my bib, drove home, slept in my own bed, and then drove back the 50 minutes. So, I mean, I think in retrospect, I probably would have gotten a campsite, even though it's only 50 minutes from my house, probably would have gotten a campsite, finished that pre-race briefing. The pre-race briefing was over at about 8 o'clock at night and gone right to bed in my campsite. So I probably scrubbed 2 hours with the idea that I wanted to sleep in my own bed. And maybe in retrospect, I would have traded that for, you know, a couple hours more sleep and staying at the campground right at the start finish line.
Things are becoming a bit more clear for us, huh, Dr. Warr? I think we're leaning into some answers here, but we have more questions.
Yeah, I think that that's enough from if we're looking at our checklist on our clipboard race prep. I think we've got some ideas of how you could do better, or maybe some of the cause of this DNF. Let's get to the starting line.
Oh, hey, go ahead, Scott, Don. Can I ask that one last question? Sometimes we have underlying conditions, flu symptoms, stomach symptoms, colds, things we really don't realize until after we get out there. And you know how that goes. I feel fine. And then you get 5 miles or 10 miles into a race and you're like, whoa, I'm not myself. Did you feel like you were at the top of your health game?
I think health-wise, yes. I do think probably diet we've been moving. We're kind of halfway into our kitchen. We've kind of been flying by the seat of our pants with our meals this past week. And I probably didn't eat either as much or as healthily, or even more to the point, on like a normal schedule. You know, I might have eaten dinner, I don't know, Tuesday night at 9 o'clock because we were unpacking boxes or something like that, right? So I don't think I was in the normal routine of eating dinner at 7 o'clock, of, you know, spending time reading it in my bed at night, those kinds of things. I wasn't in, so not health wise, but I think in terms of routine, life's routines, it was not a normal week of my life's routines.
Scott, we're not used to having our patients speak to us because usually they're a bit quieter. So it's nice to have this kind of details. And we never thought of that nutrition question, which was great insight. Thank you, patient. Go ahead, Scott. We're at the starting line.
Yeah, we're at the starting line now. We've done all the prep work and analyzed the prep work. Let's talk about the starting line. You have the bib pinned on. You're getting ready pre-dawn for the gun to go off. What is your confidence level on a scale of 1 to 10?
It's interesting. The dynamic at the starting line for most of the people in the race, this was their A goal race. You know, this is a big local race in this part of Pennsylvania. People coming from all the surrounding states. It fills up in a matter of minutes. When it goes live, it's a Western States qualifier. It's extremely well run. And so there was the energy at the start, and even the first 2 mile and a half are on road, like a lot of races, to spread the field out. And people just took off. And I was like, wow, they're cranking for a 100K. So there was a lot. My confidence, I felt fine. I felt like I'm ready for this. I'm going to take it slow and easy from the start. But I was out of sync with the starting line energy because I was there as a training run and most everybody was there as their A goal race. And add to it, as we're coming out of the pandemic, I think we're seeing this in a lot of races. The energy around starting lines and around races in general, people seeing each other again, it's all ramped up. And so you can't help but be impacted by that, even if you're someone like me who's a veteran of quite a few ultras. You know, you feel that electricity. So I would say your confidence question, it was probably a 7. You know, I was not there thinking I was going to have a great day. I was not there, but I was certainly not there thinking I was only going to make it 22 miles.
So when we're at starting lines of races, sometimes we have to be honest with ourselves and acknowledge, you know what? I have a weakness here. I have something I need to protect, something I need to watch closely, whether it's the gut, whether it's a knee, whether it's just a mental positive attitude, something you need to pay close attention to. Did you have anything at that start line that you said, today, Andy, you better watch this and manage this, watch for clues early and make appropriate actions? Did you have anything like that?
No doubt about it. My hips. I haven't had anything as acute as I ended up having in this race, but in my last 3 months of running, even going back earlier than that, you might recall we did the 100-mile training week episode a little ways back. I have this issue of the hip flexor, this weakness. It is a weakness. There's no doubt in my left hip flexor and the muscles and tendons that even wrap around to my butt. I knew that I had to be aware of that. I didn't think it was going to be as debilitating as it turned out to be, but I knew I had to be aware of it. And it was in not only the back of my mind, but the front of my mind.
Have you had this situation raise its head in either a training run or a race prior
to this one? Not in a race, but yes, in a training run, to the extent where there was an event there was a run. I was out on a 20 miler about, I want to say 5 weeks ago. And I got to mile 15 and it flared up and I called my wife and she came and picked me up. So it was a feeling. It was a familiar feeling. It wasn't the first time I'd ever had this. It was the first time I'd had it in an ultra. Remember, I'd run a 94 mile stage race in March, a 50 miler in April, and a 50 miler in May with no ill effects, with this not happening. So again, this capricious, and yet out on a 20 miler on the flat roads of Arkansas, poof, it happened 5 weeks ago. So that does float around in my head. And I think for me moving forward, you know, one of the great learning experiences about this DNF will be when those things are floating around in your head, you have to listen to them. You can't ignore them. You can't try to repress them. And if it's enough of a doubt that you really have self-doubt, then you need to tell somebody about it, whether it's your significant other, your children, your close friends, people who are there crewing you. When I ultimately dropped, it was interesting because I dropped so early. Shelley and Tully, who were crewing me, weren't even there yet. You know, they were planning on meeting me for the first time at mile 35, right? And so, of course, I drop out at mile 22. I go back to the start-finish line, and they're not even there yet. And they're like, what the heck's going on? And, you know, I explained it, and they were like, oh, and Tully was great. He's like, man, I didn't know you were that smart. Those were his exact words, you know? And so... I think you're right. I know you're right, Scott, that those things that might be floating around in the back of your head, we have to name them and claim them. And even going through that campground for those first 2 miles, I was like, got to be aware of that hip. Got to be aware.
Sometimes when we're at the starting line and we acknowledge, like Don was saying, we acknowledge these concerns or these weaknesses, we have a strategy, or if we've gone through it before, we know what needs to happen if that gauge goes into the red. If something happens with blisters, I know what I need to do with blisters. I need to stop right away. I need to take care of them. If my stomach goes south, this is what I need to do. In this situation, it sounds like even though you've had the situation rear its head, you didn't have a solution or any way to manage past the situation. Is that correct?
Yeah, I felt like this was only going to be solved by stopping. I will say that for the very short but very hilly 3 miles between mile 19 and mile 22. It was up, down, up, down, up. I had stopped at mile 19. I had regrouped. I'd eaten a lot of food. I put ice on my hip. I was thinking, okay, I'm hitting reset now. But in that very brief 3 mile stretch that maybe took 55 minutes, I realized it was not going to reset so quickly. And I looked at my watch and I thought there are 19 hour cutoffs in this race, a 19 hour absolute cutoff. I looked at my watch. I'd only been going 6 hours, right? So I had 13 hours to run 40 miles. I could do that or walk. I could probably walk this whole thing and do an 18:45 or something, maybe do some damage that I wasn't aware of. I will remember that 3 mile stretch for the rest of my ultra career in the way in which it became a real searching inward in why I do this and what's going to happen to me if I stop. And this morning I don't regret it. I feel like I made the decision that I had to make, and I will learn from it and prepare in ways that will hopefully make this the only DNF I ever have.
In retrospect, is there something you could have seen early or changed? And I ask this question not only for your hip in this situation, but for the rest of us listening. Are there early cues or clues that we should adhere to or acknowledge to prevent these types of outcomes?
Well, I think in general, if you have some doubts, you know, so as I mentioned, just going through the campground roads, I had some doubts about my hip, just dealing with my pole breaking at mile two. Like there were some doubts that crept in. The only other time I had felt that was in Hard Rock in 2016, which I had doubts early in the race about my ability to finish it. And ultimately, because Hard Rock has such generous cutoffs, I was able to, you know, completely regroup and hit reset and take a 3 hour nap and so forth. But this was a more acute version of that. And I think the learning experience, again, as I just said, is to listen to those doubts, acknowledge those doubts, and possibly even tell somebody about them. I think that is very affirming.
What I'm hearing and thinking about as we have this conversation is that sometimes we don't want to back off or make an adjustment because it's going to cost us time that we want to try to conserve. We're not going to be on our pace that we would like. But I think, you know, what's the old saying? A stitch in time saves nine or something like that. If we're able to make that correction early and maybe stretch out a 15-minute period of modifying gait or getting new nutrition in or getting the rock out of the shoe, any of those things, that small time at the adjustment before it goes off the rails, you know, before your race then becomes a spot where you need a 3 hour nap at Hard Rock to put yourself back together. There could have been a 15 or 30 minute period that you backed off intensity by 50% and really saved quite a bit of your race. Recognizing early is so critical to avoid a DNF.
Right, and I think I probably could have done that. What I was this course tests you mentally too, because it's like a lot of difficult ultra trail courses, it has its easy sections, right? They may be little. It may just be a 1 mile of smooth trail, or it bops out onto a dirt road for a little bit. And even as early as mile 10 and 11, I was intentionally working hard to take advantage of those sections and run them faster, probably than I should have that early in the race. I'm not saying that necessarily was the cause of the DNF, but I would be like, oh my gosh, I've just done a 19-minute mile through this rock garden, and now I'm out on a dirt road. I'm going to drop a 9-minute mile, right? I did that a couple of times, and, you know, as I think about it, that might have not been wise. Don, it might have been better to just shuffle along, eat some food in there, do a 13-minute mile. Don't try to make it all up all of a sudden. And when I look back at Hard Rock 2016, the same thing was true. There are these places where you come out onto these nice roads and they're downhill and they're smooth. you know, after being up so high and rocky terrain, and you want to make time on those. So I would probably rewind the tape. I'm saying I might still have slipped and had my hip injury regardless, but I might rewind the tape and not sort of try to be so overzealous on those runnable parts.
Andy, when we're going through it, whether it's a training run or a race, and something happens like it did to you on this race, where does your mental mind go? I know that it's sometimes you can say, you know what, I'm going to put it out of my mind and I'm going to think about the positive things and just get on with it. There's really nothing I can do. Or there's the complaining that comes in. Oh my gosh, you know, my stomach just went south. I can't hold anything down, and you start complaining, and that builds upon itself. Where was your mind?
So there were three parts. The first part, there was a nice runnable section. We actually even went out on a little paved road, made a left-hand turn, had to climb over. This is an interesting tidbit. Had to climb over a highway guardrail, right? So, you know, I felt just lifting my leg up and over this highway guardrail, right? That, ooh, I was like, ooh, that's a tender thing. I was with a group at the time, three or four other people. It was a big hiking section. And my mind went to just enjoy being with this group. It'll help you forget about the hip. So we climbed over the guardrail, just enjoyed being with the group on the climb. It was great. We chit-chatted and everything else. But get to the top of the climb, they start running, you know, getting distance on me. I start sort of running, and I'm like, I can't hang with them. So that then segued to number two, which was, I might not be able to finish this thing. My mind went to, you know, if I can't run 13-minute miles on this nice little, you know, not so technical single track section, you know, and that was then where my mental energy went to my hip and was completely distracted, which then led to stage three, which is part of what we're doing now, which was, if I drop out of this thing, I am going to get so much grief from so many people. and honestly, it took the next 7 miles to like admit that and be like, okay, well, here goes.
Hey, we'd still all accept your record of 184 and one. No doubt. That's a pretty amazing record. And I should probably do the math on what does that cost to run 184 races? Oh my goodness.
We want to welcome you to the Trail Runner Nation aid station brought to you by UCAN.
UCAN is the future of sports nutrition. Its superstarch energy is a slow-burning carb that digests easily in the stomach and delivers steady, long-lasting energy.
You're going to love it. Just try it. I know it.
For a limited number of TRN listeners, UCAN is giving away a sample pack, which includes two energy pouches and two bars for free. All you do is pay $2.95 to help cover the shipping charges.
The first 150 people to visit the link at the show notes, you can get these products for only the shipping cost, $2.95. By the way, you can get 20% off by going to ucan.co/TRN and entering the code TRN20. This podcast is also brought to you by Gooder. Summer is here, and Gooder has the slickest sunglasses available for only $25 and $35 a pair.
They are fun, fashionable, functional, and affordable. That's the four F's, Don.
I love that they don't slip or bounce and that the lenses are all polarized.
Gooder stands behind their products, too. They're backed by a 1-year warranty and a 30-day free return policy.
They'd only give back to you if you don't like it, but they also give back 1% to the planet since 2018. 1% of Gooder's annual gross sales go directly to environmental nonprofit working toward making our planet a better place.
They're also a 100% carbon neutral company, if that matters to you, and it should.
Become a Gooder wearer and make your view of the world even better, and you can get the entire order 15% off by going to gooder.com/TRN.
One thing I've noticed as you've given us some of this discussion is you've said and used the term mental energy. And there's energy to move ourselves down the trail, but you've alluded to a mental energy that you've quantified and you feel that's important. Can you talk a little bit about mental energy?
I'm glad you asked. The first time I ever talked to anybody about that topic was with Eric Skadden. You all might remember Eric Skadden, who was he and I received our 10-year buckles at Western States the same year in 2014. And I remember talking to Eric, and he has 2 second place finishes, a 3rd place finish. He came closer to winning it than I did, actually. But I asked him, hey, why do you only do one? Why do you only do Western States? Why don't you do another 100? You know, why don't you do TRT or something in the Rio del Lago or something? And he said, I only have the mental energy to do 100 miler a year. And I was like, well, what do you mean mental energy? He's like, having to focus completely on one thing for 17 or 18 hours is exhausting. And so if I don't have that energy, I'm not going to be able to do it. And I remembered that so often since after Eric and I, you know, stopped running Western States back in 2014, and even applying it to other areas of life, to my job, to my role as a parent. Like, just like our physical energy, we only have so much mental energy. We only have we have more than physical energy because it's something that's in our brain. It's not something tangible and physical that has to do with our heart and our lungs and our muscles. But nonetheless, it is an energy force. And if it's directed at something that is a distraction from the main task at hand, the main task at hand is finishing this 63-mile race. But my energy is going towards, oh, crap, my hip flexor's jacked up and we have 44 miles to go. And that the wear and tear on the brain at that point, to me, is going to even be more significant than the wear and tear on the body.
You know, those are great points. And I love the reference of Eric Skadden. What an amazing and strong runner and a great resume that he has. And not off topic, but I think interesting, and there is somewhat of a parallel when we wonder why, how come we can't do simple math? I mean, simple math out on the trail at some point becomes impossible. And I was just kind of thinking through that. And I thought to myself, the body is using so much mental energy and trying to keep ourselves moving forward. It's taking in information about where the trail is. What do I need to do with this foot? What do I feel when I put the foot down? And then making the muscles in a coordinated effort, balance us, move us forward. There's a lot of things going on that you're managing, plus keeping your eye and your brain energy on all the dials about hydration, about temperature, about where am I at on the course that I need to manage that, who's behind me, who's ahead of me, you know, whether you're racing or they're friends, doesn't matter, that we're really preoccupied and very busy, and the body doesn't need to do math. It needs to do the things we were just talking about. So it prioritizes. It says, nope, math isn't important. We're not even going to focus on that. We're going to use all of our focus on what's at hand. And so that's kind of along the mental energy discussion. And I thought maybe it was appropriate.
So how many times have you been out on a training run or a race, and you're at mile 72 and the course is 101, and you're going, okay, I can figure this out. 101 minus 72. And you sit there and you run and you run and you go, I know it's around 30, maybe.
And then you put some of the timing stuff in there, and I have X period of time to get it finished. What does that mean? Well, I don't even know.
I think it also has a big impact on decision making with nutrition. Like, now, when did I last have that gel? Or when did I say I was going to get a sandwich? I mean, you get this kind of zucchini brain in there. And
I want to know a little bit about this course. I've never heard of this race. You speak very highly of it. Tell us a little bit about the race, the race director. What's the course like?
Well, it's a fantastic race. It's in its seventh year. They were able to have a COVID year version in September, a late September. So that they're a Western States qualifier. It's 63.8 miles and 13,000 feet of climbing. It's relentlessly rocky. It's known for having some pretty long sections between aid. So you've got to plan for that. It fills up within minutes. They still fill it up the old-fashioned way with, you know, sign up on the computer. They're probably going to have to go to a lottery sometime soon here. But it's also real old-school down-home feeling. You know, it starts and finishes at a state park campground, a picnic pavilion. It's a real family-friendly race. I would say it's for East Coast ultra marathons. It should be on everybody's to-do list. I mean, it's a classic, very much like the other great East Coast races. You know, it's I've run all of those great classics in Virginia. I've run the Vermont 100 and definitely the World's End Ultra, and they have a 50K as well on the same day. It starts a couple hours later. And both of them are tough. I mean, the 50K course record is well over 5 hours, and the 100K course record is just short of 12 hours. So it's tough. You get your money's worth out there at the World's End.
How many people are running this race? Is it crowded or?
You know, I don't know exactly. I think they have 150 cap in each race, so 150 thereabouts. I'd have to look at, someone could look it up, but it's small enough to feel small and large enough that they have to have, you know, big infrastructure.
What makes it unique? What makes this race different than any other race you've run or attempted to run?
Exactly. I think the terrain comes at you immediately. The big rocky climbs. You hit your first one at mile two, and it's relentless from there. It also, and I of course didn't get this far, but it's one of those races that the last 12 miles are some of the toughest. It actually at mile 50, it hits the low point of the race at mile 50. And then the last 13 miles are just a grind. So you've got to be prepared for everything. Your feet are going to be wet for most of it. You're going to have to battle mud. You're going to have to battle bugs. There's rattlesnakes out there. There's other wildlife. I mean, it's called World's End for a reason. And they have this awesome tagline, which is World's End Ultra, run like there's no tomorrow. And it really is a great, great event. I applaud the organizers. I hope to go back next year, probably tapered, probably focus on it a little bit more. It would be great if you were in Hard Rock. So Hard Rock is, you know, in 5 weeks from now. It would be a perfect final tune-up for Hard Rock.
Andy, we talked a lot about the mental dialogue, personal self-talk that goes through. Can you share with us what happened with the community out there, the aid station workers and your fellow runners, the dialogue that happened there, the support or the harassment or, you know, which I'm sure you didn't get, but you know, what about that dialogue?
Well, I'm glad you asked. There was, a couple of little moments. There was a wonderful, older woman working the aid station. I think she's also a nurse. And she asked, you know, she asked me about my hip procedure and what exactly it entailed. She did a little examination and kind of felt some inflammation just with her hand. And she said, I think that's probably a good call. Then the gal, the aid station captain, said, well, if you're officially going to drop out, we'll need to call down. And so she called down and she said, yeah, I have a dropped runner. It's number 504. And you heard this pause at the other end of the radio and then said, mm-hmm. Holy crap, that's AJW. and she didn't know who I was. And she, the guy down at the start finish, it sounds like he knows you. And I was like, oh, yeah, he probably does. And so, And so then, so then they had to find out who was going to drive up to pick me up, right? And there was a gentleman who was out, you know, delivering water. But by the way, I should say it was a really, really hot day, 92 degrees and high humidity, and ooh, nobody had been prepared for the humidity or heat. So they were running out of water, and it was a real, they were doing a good job replacing the water. It's not like they were running out and saying, sorry, we don't have any water. But this one guy who gave me the ride back was basically running water all over the course for these aid stations that were running out of water much more quickly than they had in previous years. But so, of course, he has me in this van, in this truck driving back, and he has me to himself for 15 minutes. And so he's drilling me with questions like, so this is your first DNF, isn't it? And, da, 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 and don't you feel crappy about that? And so, you know, so it was, and then, I mean, there were people then back at the start finish who were like, I'm surprised to see you here, and I hope you're okay. And I understand, you know, I know this hip has been a problem for you, and it's amazing that you even run this far with, you know, titanium hips. And so I would say if after a little bit of gentle ribbing, it was very supportive and understanding. And, you know, even David, the race director, says, well, obviously you have to come back next year and finish this thing. So that's what I plan to do. So hopefully we can do a podcast a year from now when I'm a successful World's End Ultra finisher.
Nice. Do you think you have a different appreciation or respect for a DNF? Do you view it in a way differently than you had before yesterday?
Yeah, I was stubbornly proud of the fact that I'd run 184 ultras and never had to drop. But I knew the day would come. It wasn't a matter of if, but when. And I've never not appreciated, you know, everybody who has a DNF has a reason for it, and it's their, and what everybody's told me, it's their reason and their reason alone, and it's not for you to judge. And that I really believe now. You know, I believe that I made the right decision. I slept great last night. I have no regrets. But now I have a DNF, and, you know, and the one thing that I've always been worried about, and one of the things that's pushed me to finish maybe other ultras that maybe I shouldn't have, is I've always worried, and I'm not sure this is rational, but I've always worried that once I DNF one time, it'll be easier to DNF the next time. And I now I need to set about improving that wrong. You know, now I need to go into Bighorn with a renewed determination and maybe make some choices over the next 12 days that will increase my odds of successfully finishing that. Or I have two DNFs in a row and I have to live with that, which is very possible. It could happen. And so I think it has a renewed respect for, and I never disrespected people for DNFing. I think more than renewed respect, it means like now I'm part of the club. You know, I was a proud member of the never DNF'd club. And now I think I'm a equally proud member of the DNF club. And let's face it, there's a lot more people in the DNF club than in the non-DNF club.
I was just going to say, it gets lonely over there in that other club you were in. There's not a lot of people there. Yeah, but, you know, I think there's a smaller chance of DNFing. I don't think you get on that slippery slope. I remember my very first long ultra, and I was prepared for catastrophe, the worst situation you can imagine. I mentally prepared myself for just the worst. And I would push through anything. And I think that my success at my first one is because I just didn't want to not be able to do it. I think I was tougher than ever on my very first one. I think the opportunity to fail would have been on my second one because I had done it before. And so I think that after a DNF, you go in with the renewed determination, like, this isn't going to happen to me again. I'm going to get this done. And so I think the chances of you DNFing for the second time in a row, very unlikely. I think you've got another 184 in front of you before it happens again.
Well, I don't know about that, but I'm glad you mentioned that, because a lot of what I spoke about with Shelley and Tully afterward as we drove home and yesterday evening was precisely that. Like, Dad, Tully especially, Dad, you knew this was eventually going to happen. I think it's going to make you stronger for Bighorn and for Javelina and for whatever else might be down the pike, not weaker. And so I'm ready for that. I'm ready for that renewed sense of, you know, there is a risk of DNFing every time you you toe the starting line. And I had been fortunate enough to not experience that, but now I have. And just like every other experience in this sport that I've had, I'm going to learn from it and pick myself up off the mat, dust myself off, and get back out there again tomorrow.
Yeah, HAW, you've earned your stripes in the DNF club, but I don't think that you've earned all of your stripes, because there's a mental DNF that happens too, and you haven't tasted that, where you just lose the will to run, where you lose the will to even finish. And that's a different type of DNF and a different animal to wrestle, the mental DNF. You'd had a physical DNF, and I would say that those are two different styles. But you're still in the club, but I think there's another taste for just lying down in the middle of a trail and saying, done. You haven't had to do that yet.
There's a disappointment factor, right? You were okay with the decision, and it was a smart decision. It was the right decision. Sometimes, in my case, my DNF was a disappointment. I failed, and it was a disappointment. I could have continued. So go ahead.
I was going to say, with respect to disappointment, I worked with a wonderful child psychologist when I was teaching out in the Bay Area. And she talked about what she called the disappointment muscle, and that we all need to develop our own disappointment muscle. And I think I did. I think my disappointment muscle got a little shot of adrenaline yesterday. You know, I'd had disappointments in not finishing a race as fast as I wanted to, or in as less pain, but I'd never had the disappointment of going back to the finish line in a car. And that, I think my muscle got a little developed yesterday, and maybe that will help in dealing with future disappointments moving forward, because now I've had that experience that thousands and thousands of other ultra runners have had since the sport started.
So AJW, if you were to tell the story, someone came up to you and said, "What happened?" What would you tell them?
And I think most listeners know this, you know, I have two artificially repaired hips. My left hip had hip resurfacing in 2015 and my right in 2018. And ultimately it was a hip problem, a hip injury that caused me to have to DNF. And I'll explain. Dr. Gross was my physician from the time of the first surgery, after I had recovered and had gone back for my 6-month checkup. He said, "Now I just want you to know, you have an abnormal body, and you are going to have an abnormal body for the rest of your life. And there may be times when your body behaves in certain ways that you can't predict." He said, "Your hip joint is in fine shape and will be in fine shape for the rest of your life. But all of the muscles and tendons around your hip will always be at risk." So yesterday at around mile 12, at a particularly technical part of trail, I slipped in the mud. I caught myself, but I slipped in the mud, and I, for lack of a non-technical term, I think I overextended my left leg. And after that slip, I jogged a little bit, and I started to feel what I would only describe as kind of a sharp pain in the front of my hip. I can point to it right now and make it hurt. Over the next couple of miles, this course at World's End 100K is really, really rocky, with a lot of big step ups and step downs. So I had to navigate these. And each time I stepped up or stepped down, I felt more of a tweak in that left hip, precisely in that hip flexor. I got to mile 19. I stopped. I sat down. I put ice on it. I talked to the aid station volunteers. I explained my situation. A couple of them said, well, we can give you some Advil. I said, no, I don't want any ibuprofen. Let me just sit here for 5 minutes and move on. And literally, after about 5 minutes, I got up and I started hiking out of there. And really, 3 miles later, it was an easy decision to make. I knew that I was not going to have that hip feel any better. And mentally, all of my mental energy stopped going from the course and enjoying the race and thinking about the climbs and descents. All of my mental energy was directed towards this hip flexor pain that I just felt was not going to go away until I stopped for an extended period of time, which I did. Interestingly enough, this morning I went out for a 5 mile run, no problem at all, which is also what Dr. Gross said would happen, is that you'll have these weird, capricious times where your hip behaves in ways you can't predict. And just like that, it'll go away. And it just so happened that for the first time, because I've probably run 12 ultras since my second hip was done, including a sub 20 hour 100 miler. And I'd never had this problem. I'd even run in some that are muddy and some that have big rocky step ups. But for whatever reason, it happened at this point, and my mind said, nope, click off, time to call it a day at 22 and a half miles.
With all of your experience that you have, you're looking to write a book. You've talked about it. I don't think you could have a book and have it completely filled with the experience of ultra running without tasting a little DNF. I think it would be short a chapter. So for those of us that look forward to reading that book, I'm glad it happened, AJW. I'm glad it happened.
Well, maybe now's the time. Maybe now's the time that I've had the DNF to sit down and write the book. I mean, because the texts came flooding in when word got out about this DNF. I will certainly be writing a postmortem about it this Friday in I Run Far.
Oh,
so obviously a lot of what we've talked about today will be part of that. But I owe it to the people who've been reading that column for 10 years to tell this story. So I think probably justifiably so, there's a lot of people out there who are I don't want to say happy that this has happened to me, but might just be nodding their head and like, okay, now AJW really knows everything about the sport.
Andy, this is the way that I view it. You have now become more relatable to me because I cannot relate to the 2005 Western States second place finish. I can't relate to 184 finishes, but I can relate to a DNF. So you're more relatable to me. Thank you.
Well, that Scott, that means a lot, actually, because that's something that I hope that I can be to a lot of different people. At the end of the day, I'm just a guy who loves to run long distances. And you know, yesterday, I just didn't get to run as long as I had hoped.
And with that, go out and run.
No. I have one last question.
Scott, that was a wrap. You didn't recognize a perfect wrap?
Go ahead.
184 races. I want to know, is there a piece of gear or clothing or an item that has accompanied you on all 184 races?
No. I mean, obviously I wish there was, but I mean, if I still had my handheld from my very first ultra in 1992, it would probably be a Superfund site by now. So
I was just wondering, I've seen a lot of races with a blue Patagonia sleeveless jersey that I don't think they make anymore. I want to know how many of those you have in your closet and are they slowly retiring?
I do have several of those, and maybe that was my mistake yesterday, is I didn't wear that one. I chose to wear my white and orange I Run Far singlet, which is equally threadbare, and they don't make anymore.
Okay, we can cut that out. You're right. That was a weak close for a little distraction there.
Oh, Scott, I could see that was an invaluable piece of closing comments. Those were good. So go out and run.
Mas.
We'd like to thank our Patreon supporters for helping make this possible. We appreciate their contributions and hope they're getting ready for the Cocopelli 1000.
Do we have more information about the Cocopelli Run 1000?
It's 1,000 miles.
Or kilometers.
It depends on where you're running.
We'd also like to thank our Patreon business supporter, Doug Crumley with Crumley & Associates. He's part of our nation. He's a runner, and he loves to help people perform at their best. Crumley & Associates can be found at DougCrumleyJr.com. They're a private wealth advisor service that is part of the Ameriprise Financial Services, LLC.
Hey, TRN is produced by Doug Mayer and his dog, Izzy, and hosted by two hacks, Scott, you and I. And we'd like to give a special thanks to our new sound man, Ryan, who's making this thing happen and making us sound good.